I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, imagine an America where there is universal health care, paid family leave, a right to a quality education, a robust public housing system, and laws to protect biodiversity, and a national full-court press conversion to clean, renewable energy. Sounds like a fictional utopia that's way out of reach for America, but these policies do exist in other nations around the world. Other countries have embraced solutions to some of the most difficult problems that we face in America, and they are working there, improving the quality of life for people and stabilizing their economies. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santikos studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. You know those Marvel movies with Deadpool, Spider-Man, Doctor Strange? They are milking the idea of the multiverse, the idea that infinite parallel realities exist with variations on our own reality. It's an interesting way to explore counterfactuals and ask the question, what if? And we can also ask that same question, what if, about the United States? In this alternative version of America, with the what if, universal health care is a fundamental right. Gun ownership would be managed with reasonable restrictions on personal gun ownership. Quality education would be a full right, funded and accessible for all. Housing would be treated as a necessity rather than a privilege. And climate change, the crisis, would be addressed with decisive action and not denial. To see these what-if policies in effect, you don't need a Rick and Morty portal gun, just a plane ticket, because these are in practice in nations around the world right now. Journalist Natasha Hakimi Zapata has traveled around the world uncovering how different countries are solving the problems that plague the United States. Her book is Another World is Possible, Lessons for America from Around the Globe. And Natasha, welcome to The Source.
Hey, David. Thanks so much for having me on.
So I want to thank you for the optimism. There's an optimistic tone. It's not Pollyanna, but you have an optimistic tone in your book about how these problems that seem intractable in the United States are solvable. Other countries are doing that. Can you talk about, you know, why do you have that optimism and do you still have it?
I definitely still have that optimism, and it comes from two parts of my life, really. And the book comes from two parts of my life. So there's a professional aspect to this, which is that I've been a journalist in progressive media for about 15 years now. And at the same time, as I was writing and reporting on issues in the US that, as you said, felt intractable, I had also been living abroad in a number of countries where some of these issues anyway were actually solved. And I really wanted to share those stories from this perspective of storytelling and the impact that these policies have on people's daily lives with my fellow Americans so that we can then, you know, share those stories further afield and hopefully grow our movements and coalitions. But the personal side of things is that I am from a family of undocumented immigrants. And when I was growing up, there was this real sense that my brothers and I were these little American dreams that my parents had. But as I got older, and you know, I was the first in my family to get a college degree and all of these really huge accomplishments that my parents only dreamt of, I started to feel like that American dream was actually more possible in other places. And it was really triggered by a health incident in my own family, which I write about in the book. And it goes back to my mom, who for many years could not afford health insurance, health care in the US and had untreated, undiagnosed diabetes that became so severe She only actually found out she had it when she was rushed to the emergency room and had to have her right foot amputated. And that, in that moment in which she was calling me from a hospital to tell me that this was going to happen, I was flooded with this concern for her well-being, for her health, but also this added concern of how are we going to pay for the care she needs moving forward? How are we going to afford the insulin she needs to survive? And I knew, because I had lived in countries like the UK where I live now that had universal health care, that this didn't need to be the case. That when it comes to a lot of things, other countries are doing better by their citizens than the US is. And I knew we could do better, and this is where my optimism comes from, because I'd seen better.
So you mentioned the UK system, the National Health Service that they have, and that's been held up as like, well, the United States, why don't we have something like that? Or we have, you know, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which is not even close to what we get with what we would have if there was a National Health Service in the United States. And, you know, we frequently hear stories from people who were opposed to that saying, well, that system in the UK is broken and it's broke.
I live in the UK, as I said, and I live with that system. I do not have private health insurance. I rely on the National Health Service for all of my healthcare needs, as does my partner, who's British, and everyone in our family. And I've reported for the nation on how successive governments since the 1980s have tried and unfortunately in some ways succeeded to defund and privatize certain aspects of the National Health Service. But the reality is that all Britons still have access to quality, universal health care free at the point of delivery whenever they need it. And that experience alone is so different from what we have in the US. And just to go back a little bit to the history of the National Health Service, which I write about, this system really came out of an optimism that came from a tragedy. So it really rose from the ashes of World War II, in which Britons were rebuilding their society, coming back from fighting a war, and deciding what kind of future, what kind of society they wanted to live in, and elected their first Labour government, you know, voted out the Tories and Winston Churchill, who had gotten them through the war, because they wanted something more equitable. And at the heart of that was this National Health Service, which was the first nationwide healthcare system in the world. And despite the criticisms and despite the fact that it does have its flaws, and I'm sort of careful to report on flaws for each of these policies because I think it's important to learn from flaws as much as successes, it is still widely beloved by Britons because it is always there for them in their time of need.
And the trying to protect the National Health Service was one of the arguments that was used in favor of Brexit, saying that there would be more money available to prop up that system, which of course did not happen, but it was used as a way to convince people to vote for that that policy failure.
Exactly. It's this, Nye Bevan, who is the founder of the National Health Service, was the health minister who really brought it forward. He has this great quote, which I'll paraphrase, where he talks about how the National Health Service is on the verge of becoming so popular that even our enemies are going to start taking credit for it. And you really saw this with the Brexit vote. As you said, Boris Johnson, you know, essentially lying to the public and saying that money saved through this Brexit vote would go directly into the NHS. And that's how popular it is that people were convinced by this.
Right. So I'm going to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. How the United States could have these policies. When I come back, I'm going to talk about how we almost did have universal health care like that in the United States and how it failed. We're going to be back in 1 minute. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're with Natasha Hakimi Zapata. She has written a new book, A Different World is Possible, talking about the policies that we have. Another World is Possible, Lessons for America from Around the Globe, how other nations have policies that help the population, improve quality of life, stabilize their economy, protect the environment. Why can't we do that here? We were talking about the National Health Service in the United Kingdom and how popular that is and how it works. And in the United States, we see problems with people with medical debt, bankruptcies, people who do not get health care that they need, how it costs them lives, years off their lives. So there were multiple times in the United States, Natasha, that we almost had it. We were like at the 5-yard line. We just couldn't punch it over across the goal line. In 1945, Truman was proposing a National Health Service plan, and that was attacked as socialized medicine, and Southern Democrats said it would desegregate hospitals. In 1965, LBJ was able to pass Medicare and Medicaid, but it was deliberately limited to not allow it to have broader universal system. Nixon proposed an employer-mandated health insurance. That almost happened, but it failed. And then we had Hillary Care in the 1993-94 with the Clintons in the White House, but that was stymied by conservative media. So, I mean, it seemed like there was a recognition that this was a need in this country. There was effort behind it. Political capital was spent on trying to make it happen, and yet we saw basically the American Medical Association oppose it time and time again to keep it from happening.
So Aneirin Bevin also faced opposition from the BMA, the British Medical Association, and had to, you know, negotiate with doctors at the time, who are now some of the most ardent supporters of the NHS, by the way. I think what's really important for us to understand on the American side of things is that, and I think a lot of people already understand this, our system is very, very broken. But importantly, it's a very bad deal. So on most health indicators, the UK is doing better than the US, including the fact that Britons on average live 4 years longer than Americans. And this despite the fact that the UK is spending, in terms of percentage of GDP, about half what the US spends. And when I talk about a bad deal, I really like this piece by Matt Brunig in Jacobin a few years ago, actually, in which he talks about how when comparing labor tax rates in the OECD among other wealthy countries, if you compare the US, it's true we have a pretty low tax rate compared to other countries, including the UK. But when you take health insurance payments into account, and you should because the Affordable Care Act made it mandatory for workers to have it, you're actually looking at the second highest labor tax rate in the OECD. So a married person with two kids in the UK, their tax rate is something like 26% in a place where they have universal healthcare. In Norway, where I looked into their family-friendly policies, they have, you know, a year, 100% salary paid leave for parents and highly subsidized, high quality childcare plus universal healthcare and other great programs, it's more like 32%. In the US, it's over 43%. And yet we're not getting even access to these services.
There are lots of cases like this. You point out in your book these case studies going around the globe looking at how countries have figured things out. Norway has a family-friendly policies where they help families take care of their children and encourages families to reproduce. Singapore has affordable public housing for all. Finland's unbeatable universal public school system is also something, you know, these things, they work, they're there, they exist, they function, and there's a lot to be learned from that. I want to talk about how, you know, we, like another case where we almost had it. We almost had a Supreme Court decision that would have said that there was a constitutional right to quality education. It was a case, Rodriguez versus San Antonio Independent School District in 1973. And they were, the families in San Antonio were, went to the Supreme Court saying that, that there was an unfair system against them that would entrench educational inequality because of the way that we funded schools in Texas. And it was a 5-4 decision at the Supreme Court that would have found that equality education is a fundamental right, because without a quality education, the population doesn't understand their rights. They don't have access to all the other rights that we have in the Constitution. What good is freedom of the press if people don't have a good education, and so on? So it was like right there, we almost had it. So what did we lose, and what did, you know, Finland gain by having such great universal public schools?
There's this problem at the core of American society, in that if you are among the wealthiest Americans, you have access to the best schools, the best healthcare, the best elder care, best housing. But if you are among the majority of Americans, you have limited to no access to those same things, despite living in the wealthiest country in the history of the planet. And part of this is that we essentially provide off-ramps for those wealthy Americans. Finland decided in the 1960s onward that they were essentially going to eliminate those off-ramps for rich Finns in their public school education system. They essentially abolished private fee-charging schools and made their neighborhood schools the best school possible. This universal approach to public education has resulted in some of the best performing students in the world. And it was actually even surprising to Finns when the first PISA scores came in. These were the tests, that standardized tests that they did for OECD countries, that Finnish students were outperforming everyone else. It was surprising because they don't have standardized testing in Finland. But all of this comes back to this idea of universal public education that actually is equitably funded and also includes funding structures that help support students who need more support, those who are learning Finnish as a second language or who come from lower income backgrounds, rather than a system in which, depending on your zip code, depending on, you know, how wealthy your neighborhood is, you will get a better or worse school like what we have in the US.
And how is that working for Finland's economy?
This is one of the wonderful results of Finland's gamble on universal public education, is that it's a country with very few resources. In fact, when this policy, these big policy reforms were designed, they had a very low income economy and were looking partially to education as a way to grow their economy. And what's happened since is that, in large part, thanks to this wonderful education system, they have grown their wealth, and that wealth has been equitably distributed. And importantly, one of the things that was a little bit frustrating to me as an American going to these schools and seeing all of these wonderful classrooms and the, you know, the different approaches that Finnish teachers had in the classroom, was that many of them told me that a lot of these ideas that they were using in their classrooms, a lot of the pedagogical approaches, actually came from Americans. that had come up with it, but aren't able to apply it in their own classrooms because of the way that our education system is structured.
People argue that this sort of solution, the way to implement this, would work in a country like Finland because it's smaller and has a less diversity than the United States. And there's a lot of racism in all these, you know, ways to argue about in all these. The reason you say, why don't we have this? And I can always just say racism is the answer. But to that, people say the reason why this would never work in the United States because the United States is too big and diverse.
I find that a disingenuous framing because I've started to reframe that question in two ways. One is that I really see our diversity as an asset. We have immense resources in this country, and I mean immense human resources in that we have amazing people here, but also immense financial resources. But there's this scarcity mentality because these resources are not distributed equitably. On the other side of things, I want to reframe the question and ask, why is it that Finland can achieve this with American ideas, mind you, and yet we cannot in a country that has all of those ideas homegrown and is also, again, one of the wealthiest countries or the wealthiest country in the history of the planet? It just doesn't make sense to me. It always sounds like an excuse to not do better.
And so how do we pay for this? How would we pay for having universal quality education? How would we pay for having a national healthcare service? How would we pay for making housing a priority and not a privilege? You know, and we already have people in Washington, D.C. Screaming like stuck pigs about how we need to cut, cut, cut.
We would benefit a lot from universal programs. I'm a big believer in universal programs, as you can see from the policies I've chosen. I think that they are more equitable and less wasteful. And I'll come back to this idea of waste. And this is especially true when done in tandem with a more progressive tax system. As I said, with the example that Matt Brunig gave of the labor tax rate, most Americans are actually paying their fair share, but the wealthiest Americans and corporations are not. And we have a long way to go to reform that. But when we talk about waste within the American system, and you have these people, like you said, screaming in Washington that there needs to be less waste within government, what they're constantly ignoring is that this waste is actually coming from this overinvestment and public handouts to the private sector. And so, you know, some of the way we'll pay for things is actually through using the money we're already spending on things like healthcare, where we're overspending compared to other wealthy nations, and actually putting that towards care rather than all of this needless admin and insurance middlemen and inflated prices of medication and treatment and all, and actually preventative care. You know, even Medicare for All, which is by no means socialized medicine, by the way, it's nowhere near the National Health Service, where all hospitals are owned by the state. And all care is basically owned by the state and publicly funded. Medicare for All, a single payer, studies have shown that that would save trillions. So we're talking about savings there. The same with family friendly policies. It's an investment that pays off. And you saw it in Norway, where there's a finance minister that said that their GDP has grown by 20% thanks to women being in the workforce and family-friendly policies. So that there are a lot of ways that it's not so much about how are we going to find the money, but rather the money is already there. We just have to reconfigure how we're spending it. And then going back to this idea of universal programs being better, another really important aspect of them is they build social solidarity in this very material way.
We're taking a break. We're going to continue our conversation with journalist Natasha Hakimi-Zapata about her book, Another World is Possible, Lessons for America from Around the Globe, looking at how different policies around other nations are doing a lot of social good, improving the economy, improving quality of life. If you've got a question or a comment, what have you seen out there? 833-877-8255. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, Another World is Possible, Lessons for America from Around the Globe. We're joined by the author, journalist Natasha Hakimi-Zapata. Natasha, I mean, definitely another world is possible, but right now, looking out the window, looking at the news, it seems like the other world that is possible and more likely is a world that is slipping into a more darker world. We're elevating the individual at the cost of the community, at the cost of the collective. We seem to be going in the opposite direction of the policies that you're touting.
One big lesson I learned from most of these policies, I looked at 9 policies from 9 different countries, is that a lot of the best solutions I looked at actually came out of some of the darkest periods in these countries' histories. And so you have, like I said, the National Health Service rising from the ashes of World War II, but you also have Uruguay's record-breaking green energy transition coming from years of energy and financial crisis in the country. And then you have places like Finland, like Norway, like Singapore and Estonia, who all turn to very different policies to grow their economies when they had very few resources in a way that was best for the collective.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've lived, visited abroad, and you've seen some of these policies like UK's groundbreaking universal healthcare system, you know, would that work here? Tell us what your thoughts are. But Natasha, you know, we've seen how these policies almost came into effect in the United States, you know, but they were held back because of the system that we have in place, where we have the filibuster, a minority of senators who are from senates from states that are, you know, don't represent the majority of the people, class divisions, conservative Supreme Courts that are put in place by this out of whack Senate, corporate interests that are overblown. These seem to be holding back the United States. Can we get to these policies that you're talking about and trying to improve the quality of life for Americans and so that we can have good investments with our tax dollars, even though we have these forces in place that block major social reforms?
We have a lot of work to do. And I completely agree with the list that you just gave me, that there is so much at the heart of how our country functions that will need to be changed, will need to be reformed in order for us to have a better America that works for the many and not the few. But going back to this idea of social solidarity and the fights we've already had, we also have had a number of successes over the years in terms of labor successes, civil rights successes. And I know that we can fight and win because we have fought and won in the past. And I really want to point out something that I thought was quite hopeful that happened in the November general election. You saw what we would consider sort of deep red states like Nebraska, Alaska, Missouri, passing paid sick leave on their state ballots, sometimes with huge majorities. Like Nebraska, it was 74% of the vote. And that to me shows that regardless of what we call these ideas, whether we call them progressive, whether that we say that they're coming from the left or the right, these ideas are taking hold and Americans are fighting for them and winning.
It's good to point out like the historic context of when we had the Gilded Age with the Vanderbilts and J.P. Morgan and Robert Barons. After that, we had the progressive era. And then when we had the Roaring Twenties with the stock market and all this other inequities going on as well, we had the crash of the economy. And then we were able to get the New Deal with FDR, a lot of social changes that are now being pushed back by Elon Musk and Donald Trump. And they're saying we're living in a Gilded Age right now. And it does seem like the administration is deliberately trying to crash the economy. And I'm wondering, you know, where that will lead us if people will come together and from the ashes be able to. But I just don't want to get to the ashes. Can we just skip the ashes part and get straight to, you know, positive reforms?
I would love that. I don't want to say that we have to break everything in order to rebuild. But, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently said something like, maybe this is the end of the broken way. Maybe it's becoming so blatantly obvious to all of us that things are broken and the people who are in power now are going around showing us those cracks in a very blatant, blunt way. And I hope that that will be a part of the push behind fighting for better so that we don't get to the ashes.
Let's go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255. And Jeff, Jeff, you're on the air with Natasha Hakimi Zapata.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for having me on. Great show, a book I look forward to reading. And I only have a comment. It's possibly stating the obvious at this point in the show, but the single problem in America is that the system is aimed to take money from the poor and give it to the rich. And it causes almost all of our problems. And you guys have already addressed this. I think the only solution is an equitable tax system. But sometimes it seems so complicated that it's hard for people to follow. But I really think it's that simple. That's my comment, and I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Well, Jeff, thank you for calling. It does seem like if you're paying attention, you may have noticed that what we're witnessing is probably the greatest heist in the history of money, where we're going to be seeing extreme amounts of money, trillions of dollars, taken away from the American people and given to some select billionaires who have outsized control and influence over information that we receive. And so, Natasha, what about, you know, informing people, getting people informed about what is happening right now?
I wrote this book in a way that I hope it can reach a very broad audience. And each chapter can sort of stand on its own as a story. I tried as much as possible to make these stories feel real so that people can see that there are very real citizens in this world living with these policies and benefiting from them. I talked to not just policymakers and activists, but also and union leaders, but also to just everyday people on the streets of these countries and pass the microphone to them to tell their stories. And my hope is that people will pick up this book because maybe they're interested in one or two of the policies and then find something else that they're interested in. And I really believe that this is how we grow our coalitions, grow our movements, is that we don't always agree on everything. I don't expect everyone to agree with me on all nine policies, even though I'm passionate about all of them. But it's important that where we do have crossover, we come together and fight for those things. And so I hope that by understanding the very real impact that these policies can have on a person's daily life, that will help us broaden these movements that we're going to need to fight for better.
Let's go to Kathy on the phones. Kathy, you're on the air.
Yes. The reason that we really mustn't have general schools and all over the United States that teach the same thing is because we don't just teach academics. We teach values as well. And that's the reason many, many parents choose to send their children to private schools, parochial schools, because some of the children, I mean, they bring in drugs. Some schools will not tolerate that, and some other schools sort of look it over. So our system of choosing the schools that we decide to send our children to is better than what she's suggesting they have in Finland.
All right, Kathy, thank you for that. So what about education freedom, being able to choose what school you send your child to? Do they have that in Finland? Are people crying out for that?
I think what's really interesting about the Finnish system is that parents and wider society really trust their teachers. And a lot of that comes from the fact that you have a quality of education that's guaranteed not through standardized testing or this, and I think of it as an illusion of choice, but actually through the fact that you know that your teachers are all getting a similar training and therefore can be trusted to tailor their education to the students in their classroom. So
and you're
a
right
lot
that the teachers
autonomy.
Are compensated.
Yes, they're compensated really well. They're well respected and valued by broader society, which is so important. But as well, there's actually quite a lot of flexibility because of this teacher autonomy and because of this trust built into the broader education curriculum in Finland, and that, you know, depending on the region, can be tailored as well. So that when a teacher goes into a classroom in Finland, they actually have a lot more freedom to teach as best they can and as best they know how than American teachers do, who are often having to teach to a test that will then impact the funding structure of their schools.
Right. And here in Texas, we've seen Republican administration spend decades tearing down the public education system. Now they're claiming that it's broken. But who broke it? We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're having a conversation with Natasha Hakimi Zapata. Her book is Another World is Possible, Lessons for America from Around the Globe. Let's get to some callers. The number is 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. And Tony, you're on the air.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. You know, I lived in Europe for a while, and particularly in Spain, and they have universal health care over there. And it's a system that, you know, that definitely works. And throughout Europe, they approve of that system, and they support it 110%. And they live longer than people in the United States with this private system that we have that's squeezing the lower and middle classes. And now they're cutting Medicaid here, which is crazy. And instead of the oligarchs who won, it was the oligarchs versus the corporatists, and the oligarchs won this time. Instead of the first thing them doing is saying, hey, we have to pay higher taxes so we can, you know, invest in the things we need as America so we can make America great again. You know, they're not doing that. They're doing something totally different, you know, a lot of smoke screens. But ultimately, I'll finish off with just by saying that Trump would be perfect for the guy to sell this idea of Medicare for all. You know, you started off at 55, then the next year you go to 45, then the next year you go to 35. Trump could do it because he would just say it, and 80 million people would be like, yes, 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 that's what we need.
You know, when Trump first won, there was some people like David Frum, commentators, thinking that he might do something like that, that he would break the right versus left mold and start trying to actually put together policies that would help people. It never happened. Let's go to another caller real quick because we're kind of short on time. Let's go to Sean. Is that Sean? You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, I think it's a really good lesson. California had been struggling to, or it's still struggling to get their high speed rail. It's a fraction of the distance, and it's so bloated and its cost. There's a decade of doing this, but Florida did it. They did it under Republicans. They did it cheaply, and they did it, and they're expanding. And their plan actually is kind of the model that Texas might be looking at. And so I think it's just important to note that these aren't right or left issues. It's just we all agree that it's happening and who or that we need them. And, you know, how do we figure out who has the best idea and just go with it? I think Democrats should just look to Republicans sometimes, and if they have a good idea, take it. And same thing on the opposite side. It shouldn't be a bipartisan or it shouldn't be a partisan thing. Thanks.
All right, Sean, thank you for that. We've seen in California that there's too many people who can veto any progress on major projects. Happens time and time again with projects like you talked about, high-speed rail. But what Natasha, you know, is this a right versus left issue? Is this just fine? Using going back to standard American pragmatism, what works?
I think it's so important to move beyond the political spectrum and to not see these as right or left ideas, precisely because that's how we can get things done for the many and not the few. But I'm also a big believer in public ownership over private profit. And there are definitely things that we can do to reform the way that we do things that are projects that are publicly owned. But I wanted to turn to Uruguay very quickly, where they have a publicly owned utility that's in charge of all energy in the country. And that was a huge reason they were able to transition to renewable energy so quickly, because once the government decided that that's what needed to happen, there was one utility to carry it out. And they did turn to the private sector for generation, but ensured that the way that the private sector was involved in this transition was for the benefit of all Uruguayan people and maintained control over how that energy was sold back to the state. And I think that that's very important to remember as we talk about private versus public.
Another caller, Melissa. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air.
All right. Hi there. Yeah, my name is Melissa. I am a teacher here in Texas at a wonderful public school. And I had to respond to what Kathy said. She said we can't, you know, universalize education because certainly different regions across the country and different people want different values taught in their schools. And that's why school choice is important. And I just have to say that, yes, in fact, we are parenting your children, but it's because the parents of our children in this country are having to work 40 to 60 to 80 hours a week, and that's maybe both parents. And so, unfortunately, schools have had to take on this responsibility of teaching values, but we wouldn't have to do that if we had this holistic approach that led to more equitable access to things, that parents could actually spend time parenting their children. So anyway, I would love to see parents parenting children myself, and they would be able to with family leave, for example.
Right. Appreciate that. Melissa, thanks for bringing up the family leave issue. And so you write about that in Norway's. They have a family friendly policies that is gender equitable. There is expectations for the man as well as the woman. Can you talk about that, Natasha?
Definitely. And so Norway is a great example of how investing in families is actually an economic no-brainer. You have this wonderful leave policy that's been expanded through the years and actually started from a coalition, again, from a left-wing labor government, center-left labor government, and the Christian Democrats on the right, who for very different reasons supported paid family leave. And nowadays, parents get almost a year to spend at home with their newborns that they can divide between themselves. And I want to point out that it's not because Norway was somehow more feminist than we are in the States that they decided to do this, but actually it was an economic imperative. They wanted to bring women into the formal workforce and pay for traditionally unpaid labor done by women, which, as I pointed out earlier, increased their GDP by 20%. But in order to do this, they realized that they needed to support families. And one of the reasons that I chose Norway was that not only do they have this great paid parental leave, but there are two other things. They have, as you pointed out, David, this daddy leave or papa perm, as they call it, where 3 months of that full year where parents can be home for 100% of their salary has to be taken and can't be transferred by dad or co-parent. It's a progressive country, so co-parent. And what that means is that co-parent stays home while the other parent goes back to work or school and gets to be a primary caregiver of their own accord, a genuine co-parent, and learn how to do that on their own. And there are just a number of benefits to this that have to do not just with, you know, a broader understanding in society of what it takes to raise a family, of more equitable roles within
the home. It allows people who want to have children to have children.
Yes.
And so they can't say, I can't afford it. You know, that's terrible. If you want to have children, you should be able to do that.
And another key aspect talking about affording to have children is this idea that, or this law that every Norwegian child from the age of one has access to highly subsidized, high quality childcare. And this is, you know, whether it's public or private, they're a mix. No one pays more than $400 more or less a month per child that goes to daycare. That is a huge, huge help for families.
I'm going to point out this and get to a call, but you write that United States is one of seven countries that does not have paid family leave. This is something that is almost universal around the planet, except for in the United States. Let's go to Edward real quickly. And Edward, you're on the air.
Hey, David Martin. This is a great show. Thanks for the guest. And David Martin, to the guest, as David Martin knows, I'm a Medicare for all liberal, let's put it that way. But he also knows that I'm a, I don't know, David, hyper pragmatist and realist. So I have a question and a comment in that framework, knowing that I'm a supporter of these programs. Basically, every single nation in the world that has successfully done this for the last, call it 80 years or so, post-World War II, hasn't had to provide for their own defense. We've done that for them. There are exceptions, but let's talk about the aggregate. It's now looking like, with them possibly starting to ramp back up their own self-defense and go into austerity and all of their economies stagnating lately, I'm very skeptical they'll be able to maintain all of these programs if we're not protecting them anymore.
All right, we're short on time, so I'm going to get to an answer, Edward. Thank you for the call. And so, Natasha.
We're definitely seeing a shift in global politics, but I am skeptical, Edward, that this is going to mean that people aren't going to protect their own services. I have seen how popular these policies are and how willing people are to fight for them, not just in Norway, but the National Health Service in the UK. All of these attempts there have been to truly break it apart have been met with huge resistance by a collective in Britain. And I think that that's one of the important things as well. Even when we get these policies, we're going to need to fight like hell to keep them.
And the point of the book is that they could work here. You're trying to just open up people's minds to know that what we experience here in the United States, the policies that we have here, this is not the only way, and it's probably not the best way to handle these problems that just have not been solved in the United States. We're short on time, but your quick answer?
I'm really proud of a lot of things that the U.S. does. I just want us to do better, and I know that we can.
And letting people know that there are other choices, another world is possible. Lessons for America from around the globe. It's the name of the book. The author is Natasha Hakimi Zapata. Natasha, thank you so much for joining us on the air today.
Thank you so much, David.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Technical support by Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, and Yvette Benavides. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.